Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. Well, the 2016 Olympic Games came to a close last night. Simone Biles carried the flag for the United States in those closing ceremonies. Given all the warnings of doom for the Rio Games, it went off pretty much without a hitch. And now Japan takes the torch. Tokyo will host the Summer Games in 2020. And when it does, we'll be in the middle of an election again. Probably President Clinton or President Trump will be defending their first term. In a moment, one author strikes out across America to find Trump voters, who they are, what they want, and where they might be in 2020, win or lose, for Donald Trump. But first, reports emerged this weekend that Donald Trump may be looking to abandon his policy to round up and deport the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country. Trump met with conservative Hispanic leaders on Saturday, where immigration did come up. Trump is doing poorly with Hispanic voters and suburban white moderates. And at first, this seemed like a standard election move to the middle. But this isn't a standard election. Trump's surrogates injected a whole lot of ambiguity into those reports. Newly minted campaign manager Kellyanne Conway was asked whether Trump still backs what he's repeatedly called a deportation force.
As the weeks unfold, he will lay out the specifics of that plan that he would implement as president of the United States. To be determined.
To be determined. Senator Jeff Sessions, another strong Trump backer, also said that Trump was struggling with policy on deportation. But to Trump's white nationalist backers, there is no ambiguity on this issue. The internet lit up with angry backlash from the alt-right. Breitbart News, which up until last week was the charge of Trump's new top campaign man, Stephen Bannon, made it clear to readers there is no movement on immigration from Trump. Now, Trump seems to have no wiggle room at all with the constituency he's chosen for this general election. Dave Weigel has been following the Trump campaign for the Washington Post and writing about the white nationalists who are celebrating a presidential run they can finally call their own.
When I saw that news, I recognized it as kind of the latest in a series of Trump floats of ideas that I think are meant now by the Conway side to say that he's not as dangerous as you might think to some voters, but not credible enough to really warn off the diehard Trump voters who voted for him before the immigration reason.
Still, there have been a number of moves of late, an appeal to African-American voters, this public meeting with Hispanic leaders, ambiguous language from Trump or at least his surrogates on immigration. What is the target audience here? Is it the minority groups that Trump is doing so poorly with, Hispanic and black voters, or is it somebody else?
On the margins, if Trump improves just a little with black and Hispanic voters, just to where Mitt Romney was, he's in better shape. So there's a little bit of that going on. But the people I've talked to, and that includes Pat Buchanan at the end of last week, recognize this as more of a signal to white voters that they can vote for Donald Trump and they're not going to be doing anything racist. They can reject everything that they hate about modern America. They can reject the Black Lives Matter movement. They can reject criticism of the police, affirmative action, et cetera, et cetera. But they have a candidate who sympathizes but is not racist.
Well, that's really interesting, Dave. That would suggest then, if that's true, that this outreach to black voters, such as it was, the meeting with Hispanic voters, is sort of the optics of moral cover for uncomfortable whites.
I would point out that Trump always had an immigration position that was sort of pragmatically brutal. There was going to be a deportation force and it would efficiently pull people out of the country, then efficiently let the good ones back in. And if this doesn't sound terribly coherent, it never was. It was just a combination of the hardest line policy on getting rid of illegal, undocumented immigrants and the soft line, actually what Mike Pence used to favor when he was in the Congress, policy of letting people work here as long as they behave well. And I guess the reason that that hasn't bothered his base is because they're worried about their threat to their livelihood. Then they are worried about immigrant crime to a degree larger than data suggests they should be. And he answered that pretty well.
So if there is this kind of ambivalent moral signaling to suburban white voters who might be uncomfortable voting for Trump, even though part of them wants to, the alt-right reacted very swiftly and very angrily to this. Now, you've been covering some of the white nationalists and others who care a lot about this issue and care a lot about the Trump campaign. Any ambiguity, Dave, they had to have known there would be a swift and angry reaction here.
There's a great faith in the Trump base, the hardcore Trump base, that he is going to act on the things they care about, and if he signals anything else, he is doing that to get elected. What they were most interested in from Trump at first was him demolishing the supporters of amnesty and the people who wanted to soften the Republican Party's approach on criminal justice reform and those kinds of things. Those guys watched Trump beat up Jeb Bush and beat up Marco Rubio, and they have a lasting affinity from that. They think that is more telling of where he's going to be than any policy that's floated during the campaign. This is a guy who hates the same thing they hate.
So Trump gives an immigration speech on Thursday where ostensibly he lays out some of this in more detail. Where does all this go, do you think, given how poorly he's doing with suburban whites, certainly with minority voters and this loyal core constituency that you're talking about on the right?
For years, but really since 2013, when Democrats tried to move on this, if you can ask the question, and this is, I think, a problem for all the many business interests that keep funding lobbying and then being surprised they don't win, you can definitely frame the question so that it sounds like people are fine with more immigration. The more elemental, more energetic opinion is against everything, and there is a sort of voter who thinks he's for immigration but doesn't like the making it incredibly easy to stay here if you're here illegally. So it's an issue where the public's perceptions are distorted, like many, but one where they've been particularly distorted because there's so many ways to ask what they want. Trump, in the speech, having not seen the text of it, if he summarizes what he said all year, which is, if you're good, you can stay in. If you're bad, we're going to kick you out hard. That might even be covered as a pivot, but people who like him for the immigration reason are going to stick with him.
The Trump base and immigration and a moving target, perhaps we'll know more on Thursday. Dave Weigel with The Washington Post. Dave, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
So whether or not Donald Trump can or even wants to moderate his stance on immigration, that'll depend a lot on who his voters really are and what they really want. Alexander Zaychuk spent a lot of time with Trump voters in places like Arizona and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, California. And the truth is that there is no single portrait of a Trump supporter. With over 13 million Trump voters in the primary, Zaychuk doesn't claim to speak for all of them. But he did get to know over 100 Trump supporters in a book that lets Trump voters speak at length for themselves. It's called The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. And Zaychuk says that race is just one part of a complex picture here.
You're not going to be able to extract the racial aspect to the Trump phenomenon and put it in this test tube and say this is quantifiable, this is how much of it is going on. It's impossible to disentangle from everything else. However, I believe after talking to all these people, and again, just six dates, not 13 million of them, and I can't say for certain how honest everyone was with me, but I did get to know these people quite well. I spent a good amount of time with them. I do not believe that there are racial anxieties driving this. I don't think that is very high up in the mix for most people. I do believe this is primarily an economic phenomenon. And I know there's a debate around the Gallup poll saying, well, according to these interviews, these people are not as quote unquote directly impacted by trade competition. But I think that's a very narrow view, and trying to understand the Trump phenomenon with statistics is what led us to the utter disaster of the pundit class getting it wrong at every stage up until now.
Okay, but let's back away from it a little bit then, because minorities have experienced much of the same economic impact of trade, much of the same economic anxiety, the same pressure from wages. Mm-hmm. Latinos have experienced it. Black folks have experienced it. And their support for Trump is basically zero.
Sure.
And in the case of Latinos, hovers around 20%. So that's hard to square with what you're saying.
That's where culture comes in. And then you say, well, that's just a racist culture. And yes and no, it's complicated. And I know that seems like a cop-out, but it's also true. And I think that's gotten lost in this debate where people think it has to be one or the other. But I do believe that the average Trump supporter is not only necessarily a sort of blunt racist, but generally has more empathy. And if you talk to these people at length, as I have, I just didn't encounter a lot of racism. And people had plenty of opportunity to come out with it. I mean, often we were drinking a lot of beers, and I wasn't, you know, challenging people or pouncing on them for saying something that was offensive. You know, and they're more culturally comfortable with Trump as opposed to a candidate, say, a candidate like Sanders, who is maybe making similar arguments with regard to trade. Culture matters, and it's not reducible to racism.
Well, you went through Pennsylvania in this book, and it's one of the chapters that was closest to my heart because that's where I'm from. You sat down with a couple of former coal miners in Western PA. I just want to read this one passage because, to me, it kind of distilled a lot of the Trump phenomenon. You have one subject who says, "We have veterans in our streets. When you have a war veteran sleeping on cardboard, somebody dropped the ball. I don't believe Trump will allow that to happen anymore. I really don't. I believe if he takes office, the economy is going to change. My biggest and only concern with him is he may create World War III." I mean, that's just my only concern. The world may be destroyed, take care of the economy.
Yeah, that was John Beattie, who is a great interview subject. I spent a few days with him. He's a former miner, currently on disability. You spend time with a guy like Beattie, and caricatures get, you know, complicated. And that was sort of the whole point of this. We're sort of in gladiatorial mode now, and everyone wants an easy kind of profile that they can just hang and stop thinking about this. But if you spend time with the average Trump supporter, there's a very good chance, not necessarily, not guaranteed, but there's a very good chance that the caricature, the stereotype, will be severely compromised. Because often the same person who's shouting something at a rally, you know, you get them outside of that environment and you give them time to reflect. There's a lot of self-awareness and critical thinking there that you wouldn't expect.
Let's assume for the end of this interview that Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president. What happens to this phenomenon if and when Donald Trump loses this election?
Well, it's going to curdle, and my guess is grow, and there's going to be a lot of people trying to pick up the pieces. And in a way, the story right now is a race against – I don't want to be too dramatic, but sort of race against time to see who can answer the needs of these people first, whether it's something darker than is represented by Trump's campaign or something more broad and inclusive and more American in its promise.
The book is The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America by Alexander Zaychik, a trip through the Rust Belt, through the middle of America, talking to hundreds of Donald Trump voters. Alexander Zaychik, thanks for being on.
You're very welcome.
Unrest and violence continue in Turkey. On Saturday night, a suicide bomb tore through a wedding ceremony in the city of Gaziantep, killing more than 50 people and injuring nearly 70. Many of the victims were children. The attack came as guests poured into a densely crowded street, and it left the walls marked with blood and burn marks. Officials have found remnants of a detonated suicide vest at the bomb site. So far, no group has claimed responsibility. This devastating incident comes just months after a failed coup attempt to take over President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's government, and just 2 months after bombings at Ataturk Airport left 44 people dead. Joining us now is Saner Çayapte, director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We've seen reports that the suicide bomber in this case was between 12 and 14 years old. How does that devastating news affect how Turkish people internalize the violence that's going on now?
Unfortunately, and that breaks my heart, things in Turkey will probably get worse before they get better. And I think where it will get worse is going to be more ISIS attacks. In my view, ISIS has used the lull in the aftermath of the failed coup plot to smuggle a large number of operatives into Turkey. And they were anticipating that with the U.S. push to take cities such as Raqqa and Mosul from them in Iraq and Syria, they would soon be squeezed out of their country. So my hunch is that ISIS will be moving operations to more symbolically significant countries such as secular Western democratic Turkey. So Turkey being next door, of course, to Syria. I think, unfortunately, that they used the stalemate in the aftermath of the coup to smuggle operatives. And some of these guys are now apparently going online. So that's really devastating news.
You say an ISIS attack. Is that an educated opinion or is there confirmation of that?
That's an educated opinion and almost a confirmation. And I can tell you that ISIS will probably never take responsibility for this attack. It has never taken responsibility for past attacks in Turkey, and it does not take responsibility for attacks in Muslim-majority countries. Unlike in the U.S., where ISIS likes to claim responsibility because this is how it gets crazy recruits join the group. In Muslim countries, it doesn't do so because it purports to represent Muslims, so it would be offensive to Muslims if the group came out and claimed responsibility for the attacks. And what it does instead is it creates an air of fog and nebulous political environment. By not taking responsibility, ISIS then hopes that the societal polarization in those countries will be triggered and groups will start blaming each other for the attacks. And in Turkey, of course, this was an attack on a Kurdish bombing. So expect the Kurds to start blaming the government for not protecting them and expect the government for blaming them for blaming them. And I think that is exactly what ISIS is after. It is after polarizing Turkey further. It will not take responsibility for this attack.
Now, there's an ongoing rivalry between ethnic Kurds in Turkey and the government. Of course, that's a very old rivalry. There are Kurdish factions in Syria and in Iraq that are important in the battle against ISIS in those countries. So you're suggesting that ISIS is trying to inject itself into the Kurdish part of this debate and sow even more dissension there.
That's the other part of the bad news, that the war in Syria now risks being imported into Turkey. There's a war in Syria between Kurds, Syrian Kurdish party called Party for Democratic Unity, PYD, and ISIS there, as well as in Iraq, where the Kurds are fighting ISIS. There is a Kurdish community in Turkey also, and some of these Kurds are sympathetic to the political achievements of the Kurds in Syria especially, and there are links between those groups inside Turkey, the Kurdish groups, and inside Syria. Now, I think this is ISIS's way of importing Syria's battle into Turkey. The Kurd on ISIS dynamic is being imported into Turkey, where ISIS is targeting Kurds inside Turkey. So unfortunately, this is a fallback of Turkey's activist policy in Syria, where Turkey has tried so far in vain to oust the Assad regime, but it has also exposed the country to risks coming from Syria. And one of these is that Turkey now risks becoming a battleground for ISIS versus Kurdish battle.
As bad as that is, what is the opportunity here? Does ISIS risk in some way unifying the Kurds in Turkey and the Turkish government if it's mounting and helping to mount attacks inside of Turkey?
If the Turkish government and the Kurds in the country stop blaming each other and unify that this is an attack on the country and its institutions and its entire citizenry, I think that will be an opportunity. But the first signs of that, as I was watching the media this morning, that the Kurdish groups in Turkey and parties are blaming the government, and this is exactly what ISIS wants to achieve. There's also a part of quote-unquote domestic baseball here. It is that Turkey was just about to launch an attack from inside Turkey, next door into Syria, to capture a couple of towns that were in ISIS hands. And I think this is also ISIS retaliating against the Turkish government, saying, do not come close to my areas in Syria. I will hurt you very badly. And I think there is a risk here that ISIS could carry out further attacks in Turkey, unfortunately, because they have used Turkish territory in the last few years to smuggle recruits and fighters in Turkey. They know the weaknesses of the Turkish system. And on top of it, it's my analytical hunch that they have used the stalemate in the aftermath of the failed coup to smuggle a whole bunch of operatives and maybe even leaders into Turkey. So unfortunately, especially southern Turkey, close to the Syrian border, perhaps not the large cities, could soon become targets for further ISIS attacks coming up, as the group also wants to create splits there between the government and the Kurds.
On the other hand, I wonder if Recep Erdogan has additional motivation to show toughness, to maybe mount these attacks that you're talking about in Syria, given the fact that he's just faced a coup attempt. He may want to show strength and unity on the Turkish side.
That's correct. The Turkish military is paralyzed. It has lost nearly 30 to 40% of its top brass and generals who are implicated in the coup plot. Not the entire military participated, but large enough portions of it did that. The military has lost large amounts of skill, talent from its skill pool, as well as its top brass. So Turkish military is in no form or shape to launch a full-scale invasion of Syria to punish ISIS. And the group knows that. And that leaves Turkey more reliant on the United States, on NATO, both to protect itself against ISIS and threats from Syria, as well as to work with the U.S. to take out this group more actively inside Syria.
New attacks inside Turkey. Many analysts, including Soner Çayapte, believe ISIS is responsible. He's director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks a lot, Soner.
Thank you.
After almost 6 years, the United Nations has finally acknowledged its role in the cholera outbreak that devastated Haiti shortly after the earthquake that crippled the country. It was a confidential UN report that urged the Secretary General to admit that it was UN peacekeepers from Nepal who caused that outbreak, which killed at least 10,000 people and sickened hundreds of thousands in Haiti. Dr. Louise Ivers is Senior Health and Policy Advisor at Partners in Health and Associate Professor at Harvard Medical School. She just returned from Haiti and will be going back again next week. She joins me now from partner station WGBH in Boston. Dr. Ivers, welcome.
Hello.
It seems like people have known the UN was at fault for a long time now. There was a reluctance to acknowledge it. And even back at the time of the earthquake, accusations from Haitians that this was somehow spread intentionally by UN peacekeepers.
Yeah, so the outbreak started about 10 months after the earthquake. And very quickly after the outbreak, local people around the place where the first cases happened started to make protests and be complaining about what they believed was the UN's role in this. Over the years since then, most experts would agree that the epidemic started through the inactions and actions of peacekeepers who were there in central Haiti. There's no evidence that there was any willful cause of the outbreak, but it certainly seems to be the result of faulty sanitation. So one could discuss whether that's negligence, but certainly the peacekeepers are the ones who are believed to have introduced the bacteria into an extremely vulnerable environment where the epidemic then just took off like wildfire, really.
So what does it mean now for Haitians who are still there that the UN has admitted culpability, at least in a private report that was reported by the press?
It's very much just a first step. What we really need in Haiti, those of us who take care of patients, those of us who try to protect the health of the Haitian population, is action. But we've been seriously limited by resources to do that. We just don't have the money to do it. So what we're really hoping is for finances to go along with the words of culpability. So we know exactly what to do. We have a plan of action that the government of Haiti has been behind and has constructed to do vaccinations, to do water and sanitation, to treat patients. So what I'm hoping for is that the UN will now step up and actually finance that plan of action.
As devastating as the earthquake was 6 years ago, the cholera outbreak on top of it was just an additional assault on Haitian people. Is the cholera outbreak still lingering today? Are there effects that go on?
Oh, the cholera outbreak is still one of the biggest cholera outbreaks in the world right now in Haiti. Per population, there were more cases of cholera reported in Haiti in 2014 than were reported in any other country. So the number of cases compared to 2010 is substantially less. But if you just took this year or last year, it would still count as the biggest outbreak. It's just kind of fallen out of the news. And there are so many health challenges in Haiti, so many problems that everyone is dealing with, that sometimes it can be hard to focus on just one. But it's certainly a huge problem. And people are dying routinely, and families are being affected every single day by this really serious disaster.
So with diplomatic immunity, there might not be any legal recourse against the UN or the Nepalese peacekeepers, perhaps. But what are the practical dynamics now of getting the United Nations to fund the efforts that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think the legal piece can be left to the lawyers, but certainly the practical piece is that we need money. And I would certainly call on the UN to action to find the resources that are needed to finance the plan to eliminate the transmission of cholera in Haiti. And I think the UN could go a long way towards restoring goodwill and helping to actually fulfill their mission in Haiti, which was to stabilize the country. You can certainly help to stabilize a country if you help contribute to the health of the population. So that would go a long way towards raising the funds to help us to do that.
Dr. Louise Ivers is Associate Professor at Harvard Medical School.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
As homeowners and firefighters in California are learning, preparing for a natural disaster is about a lot more than stocking up on water and supplies. Training matters here. And if you live in an earthquake-prone area, in grade school you probably had those drop, cover, and hold drills. The question is, though, can you test an entire city? It turns out you can, and that's exactly what they did in Portland, Oregon. The west coast of the United States is overdue for a massive earthquake. Experts say it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So to get ready for this inevitable disaster, this summer, officials across the Pacific Northwest simulated their response. With dozens of cities, state and federal agencies all mobilizing their emergency teams, it was the largest event of its kind. Cassandra Profita from Oregon Public Broadcasting reports on what happened when a simulated earthquake disaster hit Portland.
All right, let's get victim over here.
A firefighter and a National Guardsman are checking for bodies in a pile of crumpled cars at the base of a tower. They pull a dummy out of one of the cars, one of the few survivors of the simulated earthquake emergency. They strap the dummy onto a backboard and hook it onto a set of ropes hanging from the tower.
Ready to hoist victim?
The scene is designed to mimic one of many disastrous situations that would follow a major quake. Matthew Silva is overseeing the operation for the Portland Fire Department.
Basically, we have an overpass that's crashed down. We've got three vehicles down there, multiple victims that are trapped at the bottom of this ravine, at the bottom of the overpass.
To get to the pileup, the first responders had to rappel down from the tower. Now, they need to hoist the patients back up to safety.
Patient ready?
So, I'll go ahead and get started as people file in.
Across town, a dozen city officials gather inside a conference room at Portland's Emergency Coordination Center.
So the people that should be here, we have the unified command here.
They're wearing colored vests that correspond to their roles in responding to the biggest emergency Portland may ever see.
Yes. Is everybody here? Mm-hmm. Okay, can we have them go ahead and introduce themselves?
Rich Denhouse, Fire.
Okay. David Peters, Water.
Steve Townsend, Transportation.
Their job is to review the situation and direct the next phase of the simulated emergency response. But first, a headcount.
So do we have we have finances here also, correct? What is our yellow-vested friend? What
are logistics.
You? Your logistics?
Yep.
Is there finance in here?
No, that's a green glass.
Yes, are they not? Okay.
Right off the bat, Planning Chief Marty Shaw notes they're missing a green-vested member of the finance team, and the electronic whiteboard isn't working. But that's the least of their worries. He turns to Police Lieutenant Ashton Brewer for a situation report.
The incident summary, I'm not going to read all this. We'll just review 9.0 Cascadia Subduction Zone earthquake this morning at 0800. Aerial reports show widespread damages across the region. Active fires, hazardous materials, and mass casualty events have been reported throughout the city. Streets and roadways are inaccessible in most areas due to downed power lines, trees, road signs, abandoned and damaged vehicles, and building debris.
Now remember, this is only a drill, but the situation is bleak. Almost all the bridges over the Willamette River are down, along with the phone lines, water, and power. Hundreds of buildings have collapsed, and many streets and sidewalks are buried under several feet of debris. Emergency responders can't get to many of the worst-hit areas, and the aftershocks continue to cause additional damage.
I think that pretty much wraps up the city's status. Chief, want to go from there?
To make matters worse, the group finds they don't even know how many city staffers are available to respond to all the emergencies. They add a new objective to their list. Identify all available city personnel and equipment in the next 12 hours. After the exercise wrapped up, officials reviewed what they learned.
Many people who are the most trained responders likely will not be able to get to work and get to the Emergency Coordination Center.
Carmen Merlot is the director of the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. She says one of the big lessons is that the city will need a lot more volunteers.
One of the things we have to do is to train a larger number of people to make sure we have some bench depth. We really can't rely on a very small cadre of people being exceptionally prepared.
The city has a vision for how everyday people can sub in for first responders when the big one hits.
Let's see if we can get this one to work. Beep.
At an upscale retirement home, volunteer program developer Ernie Jones is training new recruits to set up and operate neighborhood emergency tents.
So it's working. And so it's got an on-off volume knob. That's that. And it's got the channels. Channel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
He's holding a UHF radio, which could be their only line of emergency communication when the phones go down. Portland officials have hidden dozens of these radios, along with other essential supplies, in emergency equipment caches all over the city. Jones says they're counting on volunteers to check on their neighbors and use these supplies when the time comes.
Yeah, it's really important. We know from history that 94 to 98% of people who are helped, saved, or rescued after a disaster are helped, saved, or rescued by their neighbors, not by anybody else, not by firefighters, police, or other professional first responders. And that's not because the police and firefighters and others don't want to help. It's because there's not enough of them.
Jones worked for FEMA during 55 disasters across the U.S. He trains volunteers to be ready for a harsh reality.
You know, we've got 30 or 31 fire stations in Portland, and the firefighters will tell you quite bluntly, big calamity happens. If they can get their fire trucks out of the station, what they're going to be doing is driving down the street in their, what they call their fire management area, the area they're responsible for, and they are going to be seeing where the greatest need is, and that's going to mean passing people on the street, waving, saying, I need help.
Carmen Merlot says the city's neighborhood volunteer program got a boost from the Pulitzer Prize-winning article, The Really Big One, in The New Yorker last year.
The interest has really just grown exponentially, and we now have, you know, over a 1,400-person wait list for these classes.
She says the city now has about 1,000 active volunteers, but it needs 10 times that amount to prepare the city's neighborhoods for the worst-case scenario. For The Takeaway, I'm Cassandra Profita, member station OPB.
To hear more from our urban resilience reporting, visit thetakeaway.org/urban resilience. 185 years ago, on August 21st, the most violent slave rebellion in the history of the South unfolded over a 48-hour period in Southampton County in Virginia. Led by Nat Turner, the rebellion, which was also known as the Southampton Insurrection, left more than 65 whites dead. And in the aftermath, the state executed 56 people, and close to 200 African Americans were killed by white militias and mobs. Turner himself was captured 2 months later, and he was sentenced to death. His confession, which was given to his attorney, Thomas Riffin Gray, was later put into writing and published as the famous Confessions of Nat Turner, the leader of the late insurrection in Southampton, Virginia. In 1967, author William Styron drew both critical acclaim and outcry for his novel of the same name. There's a movie coming out this fall that's already drawn a lot of attention. It's a new interpretation of Nat Turner's history. It's Birth of a Nation.
Let the high praise of God be on the mouths of the saints and a two-edged sword in their hands to execute vengeance on the demonic nations and punishments on those peoples, to bind their kings with chains. Dishonor have all his saints. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Sing to him a new song.
Kenneth S. Greenberg is Distinguished Professor of History at Suffolk University in Boston. He's written extensively and co-produced a documentary about Nat Turner. And Greenberg has edited the forthcoming second edition of the original Confessions of Nat Turner, which he says is American history's only direct account from a slave rebel.
Everybody agrees, everyone who's a scholar who's been through the sources, that the voice in the Confessions of Nat Turner is largely the voice of Nat Turner, with some additions from Thomas R. Gray. That makes it an almost unique document because we have no direct voices from enslaved people who were rebels other than this document from Nat Turner.
And that's worth pointing out, that of any other slave insurrection aside from this famous one in 1831, and there were many, records of them and records of the people who mounted them simply didn't survive.
Correct. And actually, there are many documents related to the Nat Turner rebellion, but almost always those are African-American voices get filtered through white voices. The Confessions is filtered, but having looked at it really carefully, lots of people agree now that it's largely the voice of Nat Turner.
Did he have an appreciation when he was giving these statements, these interviews to his white lawyer at the time, that this was the way to get his story out to the world because he knew it had to be through a white conduit?
He didn't have to speak to anybody. He was in his jail cell. He gave this confession after he was captured. He could have easily said, I'm not talking. He chose to talk, and he chose to create a narrative which he wanted to get out there. So it's an extraordinary document as a result of that.
So what additional scholarship do we have now going into the release of this second edition of The Confessions of Nat Turner that we didn't have before, not only through the original book, but then also the famous Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by William Styron, which was written in the 60s?
I think scholarship and writing about Nat Turner goes through cycles. Depending upon the current state of race relations in American society, there's a renewed interest in Nat Turner when things get tense again, when it comes to consciousness again in a big way. And that's what happened in the case of the 60s and William Styron's novel. That led to a clash between Styron's vision and many black writers and white writers who said that this was essentially a racist vision. But in terms of scholarship from historians, there's always been just the factual information, which, believe it or not, is hard to recover from 1831.
So the actual facts of the insurrection, how the conspiracy was mounted, how it was executed, et cetera.
Those kinds of facts, but even facts more basic than that, you know, many people who have looked at this said, well, if you read any history book and you pick up and you try to find out a figure like how many rebels were there, how many white people were killed, there's figures, they're within a range, but those figures are never nailed down. And the later scholarship actually does that.
There are also cases in the aftermath of this rebellion, which again was all the way back in 1831, of basically panic riots among white people, as I understand it, way into the Deep South, even though this brief insurrection took place in Virginia, white people panicking that a slave revolt was widespread and there were reprisals hundreds of miles away.
Yes, it led to panic. The governor of Virginia thought that white northern abolitionists had inspired this rebellion. Preachers had come down and their words had reached enslaved people. There were in North Carolina people who were actually arrested and tried for being part of the insurrection. None of that is clear whether anybody actually was part of the larger insurrection, but there was definitely a white panic. And then on the immediate scene, you know, the brutality of the killing, it is bloody, extremely bloody, and the whites as they come across the farms which have been attacked are absolutely furious, and there is a furious killing of African Americans as the rebellion is ended as well.
Has it ever been clear what the precise motivations of Nat Turner's compatriots were? Did they have the sense that this rebellion could spread and could actually be successful? Or was it more desperation that their situation was so dire that even a bloody end at the hands of militias or whatever authorities would descend on them was preferable to what they were experiencing?
We have no absolute clarity on this. But if you consider first Nat Turner as the one who really gave impetus to the rebellion, he clearly had in mind that they were going to move rapidly, move from farm to farm, kill everybody on every farm, creating a sense of panic and terror in the white community. And as they moved along, they would gather black recruits. And the swiftness by which they moved is extraordinary. And in fact, that is what happened in the initial moments of the rebellion. But then, you know, the ability of Virginia society to mobilize troops is extraordinary. Within a day, the white community had mobilized 3,000 armed people from militias and soldiers and so forth descending on the community.
Well, Kenneth S. Greenberg, you've spent thousands of hours poring through the historical record of the Southampton Rebellion, the Nat Turner Rebellion. What are you still dying to know? And this might be an unfair question because the historical record is what it is. And I wonder if you had the magic ability to get one set of facts into your head, what would it be?
Well, actually, you know, I would turn it to a different problem as my central problem because I study 1831 and I know Nat Turner from the original sources that we have, which are very, very difficult to read. What happens is periodically, as happened with the Styron controversy, and it looks like it's happening again with the Nate Parker film as well, is that there's a kind of a turmoil which focuses not on Nat Turner really, but on the people who were writing about Nat Turner. And my great fear is that may happen again, and that would be a sad state of affairs. Nat Turner is a great American figure. He's someone we should admire because he fought for freedom. He gave up his life for liberty. So I'd like to see that recognized. And like any hero, he has flaws, but nonetheless unrecognized. And this is true for enslaved people who rebelled in general. You can go search the country for the monuments to those people. You can go to Virginia where the rebellion happened and go to the town where it happened, and you will find no monument to Nat Turner. You will find a Confederate monument to the Confederate dead. That's a sad state of affairs.
Kenneth S. Greenberg is Distinguished Professor of History at Suffolk University in Boston, Massachusetts. He's also editor of the forthcoming second edition of The Confessions of Nat Turner. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. NASA is opening up new frontiers of public disclosure in an effort to post all NASA-funded research articles online free within a year of their publication. It's called PubSpace. You can read over 850 NASA-funded articles so far, everything from the health dangers of inhaling lunar dust to whether or not there is life on Saturn's moons. Check it out. Thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.